3, East Anglia Polytechnic.
Open it,
stuttered my mother nervously.
Yes, open it,
said Dad, frightened. Cool it, cats, I breezed. This was the 70s. In my hand was a golden envelope containing the most important pieces of paper I'd ever clutched. My A-level results. Rectangular in shape, and with my full name typed across it in ink, it looked important because it was of real importance. The foldable flap hugged the back of the sheath tightly, bound together in a solemn, gummy embrace. Unable to slip my nail beneath its coagulated clasp, I nodded to myself. I was going to have to tear the paper along the top fold. I did so, and then reached inside to extract the papery contents.
What does it say?
My parents whispered in absolute unison. I opened it as gingerly as a rookie bomb disposal operative would open a fat letter bomb in a creche. In a funny sort of way, the contents were just as explosive as a powdered acetone peroxide. They spelt the difference between me attending tertiary education and being consigned to the heap marked "Don't have A-levels," and that was a mound of slag I did not want to be on. Like the bomb disposal man mentioned above, I swallowed hard and began to remove the letter within the lope. A single bead of sweat sprinted down my face, skirting around my temple and pausing at the jaw before throwing itself to its death. I pulled the paper out further until I could make out the letters it bore, letters that had been formed into words by a kindly typist. I gulped again and looked at my parents before emitting a sigh. "Bad news," I muttered. "Your son has failed."
"At failing his exams!" They were confused momentarily by the clever double negative, so I added, "I passed!"
The "it's bad news, ha-ha, no, actually, it's good news" technique is one I've always enjoyed. It was really pioneered by Dave Coleman on Question of Sport when he tonally suggested Bill Beaumont had got an answer wrong, only to reveal at the end of the sentence that he'd got it right. The judges on ITV's X Factor use a similar technique to reveal that a singer has made it to boot camp. My parents were elated. Mum patted me, and Dad joined me in one of the first high fives that Norwich had ever seen. "I passed," I kept saying. "I passed them both." The exact grading isn't important. Suffice to say, I was the proud owner of 2 shiny A-levels, and nobody could take them away from me.
1974 was a crazy, hazy time for Alan Partridge. The 60s had come to East Anglia, and it was a time of free thinking, free love, and in my case, free university accommodation. I was quite the man about Norwich, sometimes called Naughty Norwich, striding confidently through the dreaming spires and hallowed halls of East Anglia Polytechnic, whose alumni included newswoman Selina Scott and meteorology whiz Penny Tranter, soaking up all the knowledge that this seat of learning had to offer. The free accommodation? Well, enigmatically, I had decided to stay not in the woodworm-infested squalor of university halls, but to commute in from my home, my parents' home. Although misinterpreted by some of my peers as reluctance to cut the apron strings and live independently, the decision to reside at home was a canny marshalling of my resources. It enabled me to avoid the scruffiness of my shaggy-haired, sandal-wearing colleagues. By using my rent money wisely, I was never less than beautifully shod. Of course, it also meant that I was something of a mystery man on campus. While my fellow students lived in each other's pockets and played out their debauched lifestyles for all to see, I was far less well known. I'd be glimpsed at the back of lecture halls, ghosting through the student union with a glass of cider, or shushing idiots in the library, and then I'd be gone. This all added to my aura, as did my idiosyncratic dress sense. Thick-knit zip-up cardigans, flared brown corduroys, and shiny black pepper-pot brogues set me apart from the long-haired layabouts, who bore an uncanny resemblance to the Guildford 4 and some of the Birmingham 6. Irish long-haired layabouts, wrongfully, inverted commas, convicted of bombing England. It was a time of sex, drums, and rock and roll, and these 3 things, or 4 things, depending on whether you count rock and roll as one item or 2, provided the backdrop to a very crazy time. I know for a fact that I would have developed a pretty impressive booze habit and had full sex had it not been for the fact that I was expected home for 6 to 6:30. You'll notice I said full sex. Oh, I dabbled all right. Gentlemanliness prevents me from recounting some of the early incidents involving my nascent but powerful sexuality. But suffice to say, I was no frigid. I did quite a lot of kissing, some of it vigorous enough to chap lips, mine and hers. On other occasions, I enjoyed erotic and informative afternoons with a student whose essays I was writing. Years ago, I'd have been too prudish to discuss these sexual experiences in print, but hitting 50 has given me a new candidness. I'm happy to recall those eye-opening afternoons, with me and Jemima sitting bollock naked on her bed, me exploring her body with my quivering hands, while she coquettishly feigned indifference by reading album sleeves or smoking. Young I may have been, but I was confident enough to speak my mind. This strutting young cock-certain Alan would often dish out compliments as he perused and felt her body. "You're a really busty woman, Jen," I once said. "One of the bustiest on campus." "Thanks," she said through her cigarette. "You've got quite a long torso, but your legs aren't in the least bit thick. Believe me, if I didn't have lectures, I'd love to kiss your back from top to bottom and from side to side, also diagonally." Things like that. And I knew how to party. Typically, I'd press a blade crease into my cords, comb my thick hair past my ears like a glossy hat, the style at the time, before pitching up fashionably late to a house party, where my appearance through the frosted glass of the door would provide hushed whispers of anticipation inside. Perhaps subconsciously aware that I'd soon become a disc jockey, DJ, I'd bring albums with me and sit in front of the record player, treating my fellow carousers to the latest cuts. And what cuts! You couldn't pigeonhole me if you tried. The Swingle Singers, Nana Muscuri, John Denver, The Seekers, The New Seekers, and then I'd throw them a curveball with some steel-eye span. And all the while, I'd sing along at a steady increasing volume. My warm tenor actually improved many of the tracks, some of which were marred by the rock stars of the time adopting a screechy higher register. I'd do all this while getting roaring drunk on a Watley's Party 4. It was 4 pints of foaming beer in a can, or with Shaw's Lemonade, 6 pints of shandy. What's more, I knew a lot about my selected artist and would regale the partygoers with interesting facts about the artists we were listening to. On one occasion, I woke up to find my records had disappeared, no doubt pilfered by a new convert to my fresh rock sounds. Although it was only 9 p.m, the party had completely wound down, with guests no doubt annoyed into leaving by the noisy party going on next door. Fun as these times were, I'd begun to grow disillusioned with university life. My relationship with Jemima had burned brightly, certainly on my part, but our encounters stopped when we had a blazing row. Oh, the passion of youth. On the subject of female armpit hair, on which I had and have pretty trenchant views. I'm in full agreement that women should enjoy sexual equality with men and not feel expected to live up to an unrealistic ideal. But if you're a lady and you don't shave your pits, you look like a ruddy bloke. End of. To be honest, the end of the affair came as a blessed relief. I'd experienced a colossal sexual enlightenment, learning much about my capabilities and the ins and outs of female anatomy. But Jemima was undeniably one of those uppity, overconfident types who think that they can live by their own rules. Listeners to my current radio show, don't worry, we'll come to that, will know that I actively relish the regimented parameters and enforced norms of broadcast media. Smoking doobies, buying books second-hand, and getting out of bed after midday is all well and good, it isn't, but it's far from productive. These people might be able to tell you which French films Jean-Luc Picard was in, but I bet you any money, they wouldn't be able to reattach a stopcock if it came loose. Utterly useless people. My measure of success, and it stood me in pretty good stead over the years, is how well someone would cope in the post-apocalyptic aftermath of a nuclear war. Trust me, when it comes to staving off radiation poisoning, or repopulating the human race, or restoring some semblance of sanitation, having an encyclopedic knowledge of subtitled films is going to be pretty low on the agenda. I'd much rather stand shoulder to shoulder with someone whose video collection featured one video of the Goonies and another of the Tuxedo with Jackie Chan, but who was also a Polish plumber. That's why students and their incessant status quo bashing are so wrong. Challenging conventions should be left to those of us who truly understand convention. And you can only understand convention when you've stuck rigidly to it 99% of the time. That's basic. I regretted going to university deeply. Education is clearly important, we're repeatedly told by those who have a vested interest, but it's borderline self-indulgent to devote several years of your life to a single subject, That kind of blinkered obsession with one topic at the expense of all others doesn't sit easily with me. I say that as a man who can gen up on any subject to university standard in an hour, and then chair a radio phone-in on it that informs and entertains. Wikipedia has made university education all but pointless. My mind was already on the next exciting stage of my life. What would I become? How would I make my mark? I still didn't know. But as I bellowed from a park bench to everyone and no one after another party four one night, "Alan Partridge is coming!" The same phrase I'd heard shouted up the stairs when I turned up at parties.